Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. On this episode of Wandering DMs, we are going to be talking about a particular class, namely fighters. Why should you pick fighter? How many fighters should you have in your party? Who should you fight? All that and more on this episode of Wandering DMs.
So in the past, we've done, back in season one, we did features on both clerics and thieves. So yes. We thought we should maybe start to round out the other major primary classes. And of course, in original D&D, there were only three, of which thieves was not one. So
correct.
We're doing this in the wrong order, Dan.
Well, it's interesting that we felt that there were issues to deal with, to try to pound down on clerics and thieves, which are troubling or complicated or interesting. And it never really occurred to us in season one that there was a problem with fighters or wizards that we should hash out. So I think that might have been part of it. I could be crazy.
And yet I think we've both house ruled those two classes aplenty. So I'm sure there's plenty actually to talk about.
Well, that's true, actually. That's true of it, yeah. So fighters is the first class. Yeah. Fighters is the first class. And it's kind of the default in original D&D, it's the default class. It's the one that you assume, by default, every player is playing, unless they do something extraordinary to pick something else, actually.
I mean, it has the most obvious correlation to the war game, right? Like they're your troops, your infantry. Here they are.
Right. Arguably, if you look back to original chainmail mass combat that predated D&D, everybody's a fighter, theoretically, in the standard, mundane, real-world historical simulation. And it's interesting. You know, one thing I noticed looking at the older books is that, like in original D&D, like nowadays everything's alphabetized, right? Your list of classes is presented in alphabetical order, your races, your spells. And that didn't used to be the case. In original D&D, they were presented topically. And the spells were presented topically. And the races and the humans were presented first because that's the default presumption in the game. And the very first class that's listed is fighters, even though alphabetically, you know, nowadays it comes after clerics. But it went fighter, volume one, it presented fighters, then clerics, and then what they called magic users instead of wizards.
I mean, it makes sense, right, in terms of like how you introduce someone to the game. If you think about like any time you've brought someone new into the game, typically we look at fighters as you should probably play a fighter because it's the most straightforward. You'll understand it. You don't have to wrap your brain around a million rules.
Well, that's my number one. That's going to be my number one theme for this episode. And it's interesting because, of course, you're telling me, Paul, that you were just making a fighter for yourself to play in 5th edition recently. And I saw, I think, a fairly prominent streamer on Twitter just yesterday saying, I got to play a fighter for the first time. I better study up on this, and had a picture of herself with a 5th edition player's handbook in her backyard, apparently leafing through to do research on what it takes to play a fighter. But for those of us from the old school game, we're accustomed to being able to hand a fighter and to somebody who's never played the game before and say, here's some equipment. I mean, you know what a pole is and you know what spikes are, and you know what a sword is. You just tell me what you're going to do with that and I will make rulings appropriately.
Right. Right. I mean, at that level, everything has a very strong real world corollary, right? You don't have to pretend you have magical powers or you come from a strange land or whatever. You know, very easy to sort of just behave like yourself in this weird fantasy world.
And as an adjunct to that, there's no game mechanics. You don't have to learn spells. You don't have to learn the list of spells, and you don't have to learn the list of specific skills that are available. There's just no special game mechanics. You need to, at that point, there's no feats, there's no special moves, there's no special abilities. It's just you've got a sword. That's it. Like that's your ability. You can use any weapon in the game.
Before we go into fighter abilities, because it's very interesting, let's address the elephant in the room as our friend tells us. Interesting that you say fighter instead of fighting man, or I guess wizard instead of magic user. Yep, both those. I guess cleric. Clerics are still called clerics.
Clerics
every other
still
class has been renamed.
Correct. You're right. great point. And I got to admit, I'm now habituated to saying fighter and saying wizard, but you're right. That isn't what they were called in original D&D. So maybe, Paul, we should pull up the text for those of us who aren't totally familiar with that. So you're right. In original D&D, here you are in the first couple pages of Volume 1. They are called fighting men here. There's a whole, that's not an accident. According to John Peterson, historically, in the literature, we're not talking gaming, historically in military literature, professional soldiers tended to be called fighting men. So Gygax is just following suit with the historical books that he'd read in that.
I suppose,
but that changed very quickly.
Right. Yeah, I wonder, is that because if you look at just sort of, thanks, Joshua. I knew you had a different name, and I was trying to remember it, and I was like, I can't remember his name. Hi, Joshua. Thanks for tuning in. What was I saying? So, if you look at it from a purely like military historical context, right? So, first of all, your armies were made of men, and perhaps fighting man was to distinguish them from other, hangers-on, aides-de-camp, whatever, people who were involved in the army but weren't fighting men. They don't go out and fight. They do. They're the cooks and the camp followers and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I think that's exactly the case. So among, Gygax's primary touchstones was the work by CWC Oman called The Art of War in the Middle Ages, and that's totally what Oman calls the soldiers, circa 1920 or so. On top of that, that wasn't enough, apparently it wasn't until the mid-20th century that the culture finally evolved to the point where, military historians weren't using that term anymore. But on top of that, all of the pulp literature tended to use the same term, actually. So obviously, your common heroes like Conan, Elric, Fafford, John Carter all presumably fall into this category. And John Peterson went and did the work. As you can look at, you can dig through the pulp literature for each of those types. At some point, they're explicitly called a fighting man, that exact term, in a Conan story, a Fafford story. John Carter of Mars actually has one of the novels titled John Carter, Fighting Man of Mars. So it's actually even the title of one of the books at one point. So
there you go. You can see
why someone who was approaching middle age at the time and grew up with both historical literature and fantasy pulp that tended to use that term would possibly use that term. Now that changed very quickly. I think within just a year or two, we all agree to be more welcoming, it should definitely not be gender-based like that. And even in first edition written by Gygax himself, it was called fighter already. So very quickly, within a year or two, it was called fighter, which is good.
Yep. Excellent. Anything else you want to pick out of the description here from OD&D?
Well, I mean, A, it's short, right? Yeah. And there's, like you said, there's no abilities. There's no special things to pick. There's absolutely no selections to be made as a starting player for a fighter. And right off the bat, it says your main ability is you have access to all weaponry. It's the only class in the game where that's the case for. You have all the armor, all the weapons are available. Now, they don't even actually say that, right? So actually, there can be an argument about here. It actually never says, technically, that fighting men can use all weapons. It just says you can use all magical weapons. And for some reason, that's what Gygax was focused on when he wrote all this class text, is he only talks about magical weapons for some reason. But anyway, for many of us, among the interesting things is there's a whole subsystem just for magical swords, which we have a whole episode about, Paul, as you recall.
Yep.
Special abilities, intelligent swords. And in Volume 1, the only class that can access that whole special subsystem is just fighters. So that's maybe one might say is a special ability for them. And then, of course, this ends by like half of the text here is saying if you're a top-level fighter, you can become a baron, set up a domain, get taxation. And even though that's really sketchy in the rest of the rules, at least here it seems to promise that that's a major component of the game. Is if you're a fighter, you get two things: one, magical weapons, and two, you can become a baron. That's basically all this says. So that for many of us, that sticks in our heads that that's going to be a major component of the game, even though that was never really fully fleshed out. So that's fighters.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess I could see how that comes about, right? That again, you're talking about sort of this baseline of like, oh, well, just pretend you're in this fantasy world. You can pick up stuff. Why would that be limited?
Yeah.
And then the Good other point. Classes become redactive, right? Oh, well, you're a wizard. You can't wear armor, right?
Where Good point.
Eventually, I think instead of having the like assumed baseline and then removing things, it makes more sense to say, well, you can use, right? Wizards can use only... Right. Daggers, right? Whereas fighters can use everything.
The funny thing is, I will point out in those pages that, again, he always has the tag magic on it. So when you get to wizards, they say they can only use magic daggers. And when it gets to clerics, they can say they can only use magic blunt weapons. And so potentially you actually have this debate about, can wizards use any mundane weapon? Because it didn't actually restrict them technically at that point.
Yeah.
But we're all familiar with that from major rules.
What a shocker that OD&D might be a little inspecific about
and need interpretations from the DM. Yeah. You're right.
Yep.
The other thing I'll say.
So I just wanted to dig more into access to all weapons, right? Because that's really interesting.
Great.
What an interesting feature to give a character. And it, again, it probably came about unintentionally. But I feel like that's something we end up tinkering with. And we end up tinkering with it in a kind of a back channel way, which is through the economy. So for example, Dan, in your campaign, can I make a first level fighter in full plate armor?
Good point. In my campaign, no. I just because you're right, I've increased the cost of plate armor to the point where you can't have it is when you start out. That's a really good point.
Yeah. Yeah, I ended up on my end, I wanted it to be possible, but not guaranteed.
Yeah.
And so I actually ended up setting, I think, the cost to be around an average amount of money that a starting fighter might have. So if you roll really well on your starting money, you might be able to afford plate. But if not, then maybe you have to build up to it. And I can see where that stuff comes from, right? Yeah. That's you want some gradation. You want something for the first level fighter to look forward to, right?
Yeah, I agree. And it's funny because for me, what you just described is where chainmail is for me, is you have to roll fairly well to be able to get chainmail plus a good deal of other kit. And if you roll poorly, you might only actually be able to afford leather armor. So I do think that for the that's a major place where the original D&D economy did not really make sense, is that the price of plate was way too low. And for both, you know, for me on both scores, Ron, I mean, I am interested in some amount of historical realism for mundane items like that. And two, I'm interested in good game design. And I'm like, if you do have slightly more expensive equipment, it's both more historical and it provides an experience of graduating through levels of content rather than just like having the whole kit right to begin with.
Which, by the book, is totally missing from fighters, right? The only interesting thing about fighters is that their rate, that their bonus to hit, and that their hit points go up at a higher rate than everything else, right?
Yeah.
In theory, you're going to start out with enough money to have your full plate armor. You're going to have the best armor class on day one. You're going to have the most damaging weapon on day one.
Yeah.
And so from there on out, it's just, oh, every level, what do I get? Some more hit points and another plus one. And I've had players like literally say that to me as they're playing the game.
Right.
Like, oh, I realize it's disappointing to play a fighter because what do you get? Another plus one and more hit points. It's boring.
I can see that now, right? So in retrospect, where people do expect a choice, right? A choice that's individuating their character at almost every level. I can sort of see that. But you are leaving out one important ability, Paul, that existed all through original D&D and first edition and second edition.
What's that?
they all get multiple attacks.
Interesting. That's true.
Yeah. Yep. And it's easy to forget because, but starting with, it's funny because I feel like it's almost half accidental if that's the case, is that starting with Chainmail Fantasy, you could possibly have a hero on the board and they didn't have any idea of levels and they didn't have any idea of adding numbers to hit. And so in order to make the hero more effective in combat, instead of rolling one attack, you roll four dice, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have a superhero where you get to roll eight dice. And then you switch to D&D where you do actually, you have the D20 now, and you do have increasing combat capacities. But Gygax was very consistent, is that you get extra attacks according to your level against normal creatures, right? So against, and then you have a debate about what counts as normal. So normal men, at least first level fighters, I guess, your standard goblins and orcs, all through original D&D first edition, second edition, if you're a 10th level fighter, you get to make 10 attacks per round against those types. Yep. And you're making just an unbelievably enormous number of attacks against normal types. But that was discarded in BX. So I know that you starting out in BX, you're not accustomed to that.
But I do recognize it very much from first edition AD&D. If you recall, my weird childhood system that I was
playing
was some weird combination of the BX basic set and the AD&D player's handbook, which tells us. And then we get into the weird, like, three attacks every two rounds stuff, which always like, oh, what a pain to track.
I agree. Yeah, and I don't like, I mean, I'm not fond of that that rule. And mechanically, to me, it feels like double dipping. It's like you're getting increased chance to hit plus the god's number of multiple attacks. So I'm personally not super fond of that. And it slows down time at the table. But they were very, you know, the old schoolers were very, very consistent about hanging on to that. And I would also say sometimes, like, maybe that explains these ginormous numbers of monsters that can appear.
Yep.
You know, for orcs, goblins, kobolds, they all fall into that normal man category. And then if your fighter's chopping down 10 every round, maybe you need to throw 300 at your party for it to be even a challenge.
It's really interesting because I feel like that kind of set, that kind of encounter, I don't feel like I ever really experienced that until fairly recently, within the past couple of years, at your table of playing like an outdoor hex crawl game where we come across, you know, an army of 200 goblins and we are, you know, a seventh or eighth level party. And it's actually quite a fun encounter, right? It's crazy because there's just so many opponents, but the power level is so disparate that, like, it really just comes down to how do we do the most damage as quickly as possible so that they start failing morale checks and get out of here. So very important that the fighters are able to just kind of wade in there and wipe out swaths of them, because otherwise, what, like, all my giant pluses, I'm going to really kill that one goblin, and then the wizard's going to come in and fireball and knock out half the army. So who cares?
It's true. Yeah, that's true, actually. Yep. But you're right. But there is no, so that having been said, there isn't, in classic D&D, there isn't any choice for fighters to ever make after you've chosen to make a fighter. And the only distinguishing element is possibly what kind of intelligent sword do you pick up, maybe.
Yep. So that's really interesting. I think this is a case, right, where if I go to OED Games website and I download the OED Player's Guide, you've actually added something. Something that strikes me as perhaps this standout kind of most or biggest modernism that you've allowed leak into your OD&D games.
Well, it's a good point. And sometimes people are slightly surprised by that. So obviously, starting with third edition D&D, they had this idea of feats. So I do actually use that term. Mm-hmm. I guess when this was first published in Fight On magazine number 7, when I published it, I guess we used the term fighter powers or something like that, I think was when we first published it. But I do use the term feats now. And for me, so pretty soon, even with Gygax, right, this does seem to be a gap. He very quickly spent some time trying to give fighters additional points of interest. And they tended not to be things you could choose. So he gave them the extra attacks. In the first supplement, he expanded the abilities list, right? And so for those of us that played AD&D, the very first page, you open the player's handbook and you have the strength percentage chart, right? Whereby if you had 18 strength, you get to roll percentile dice, and there's another 20 categories for 18 slash, you know, 20 versus 18 slash 85. And I remember as a kid, when I opened that up, I was like, oh, so much detail for me to dig into and learn and technical stuff. So that came up. So he introduced that in supplement one specifically, and it says it specifically in order to give fighters additional juice against the wizards. So there's the extra strength option. There's the extra attacks. And then in first edition, he introduced weapon specialization. So my defense of it is it seems like there's this tradition, even from the creator of the game, of giving fighters some extra thing. And if I just consolidate all of those types of things and call them feats, I feel like that's in the theme of you could pick the extra strength, you could pick the multiple attacks, you could pick the weapon specialization, stuff that barbarians get, stuff that rangers get in first edition. So I feel like it's in the theme, and I do wrap it up with this feats idea. Yeah. So
well, I think once every couple levels, really you can pick one. Right? I think that it's easy to look at that in the OED game supplement and say, feats, I know this from 3rd edition, I know this from 5th edition.
Right.
But it's really just using the same term to be a set of powers that you can optionally get. And it totally is, you're absolutely right. Like, I think the most common one I see taken is the extra attacks, which feeds right back into what you were just saying of that. That's always been in the game. It's always been there.
Yeah. 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 Thank you for pointing that out. I do agree with that. And the other thing for me is I'm really not super thrilled with the proliferation of classes, right? Now in 5th edition, you're up to 12 classes in the player's handbook, and they just keep expanding all the time. And it's more for new players to learn. And so for me, I would prefer to have about 3 classes to begin with. And then as time goes on, as you level up, maybe there's more choices that you can add to it. I do feel like that's a much better straightforward system. I take all the barbarian ranger stuff and make those feats. Yeah.
I think this is actually one of my favorite details in Five Torches Deep, where you start off with 4 classes, and at 3rd level, each class gets a specialization, which happens in 5th edition already, right? Okay. Already, not only do you have 12 classes, but at around 3rd level, now you got to make another choice, right? What wizard specialty are you going to have? What what path of abilities are you going to go down on the fighter side? Right. I can't even remember their names, but there's at least 2 major branches, right? There's the hero, champion, whatever, and then there's like the battle master.
Warmaster,
tactician,
I think,
Warmaster type, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff, right? There's way more than 12. Five Torches Deep I think really nicely ties old school and 5th edition well here, where you have stuff like you have your magic user class. I can't remember. Maybe they just call it wizard. No, I don't think they do. Anyway, and then at 3rd level, you get to pick a specialization, and your choices are warlock, sorcerer, or wizard.
Okay.
And that basically, right, that brings you too close to that 12 or whatever, little bit more because they start with 4.
Yeah.
No, I'm right, right? Yeah, 12. Yeah, do math. Come on, Paul, do math.
Yeah.
3 options per, you get up to 12 things. You kind of get back to parity with 5th by the time you reach 3rd level, which I think is
interesting.
It's a nice flourish. I enjoy it a lot.
Yeah. It's not, I don't mind that system. And so William in the chat there is saying that you also like feats kicking in at 4th level. So for this exact same reason, if you can have a new player maybe come in, take that as an entry choice. And then there is a decision once they've maybe sort of mastered what the normal capacities are, there's a later decision to add something. So I think we all agree, you know, 3rd, 4th, sometimes I think about 5th. There are times when I think about maybe that should have been 5th at the same time when wizards get a fireball, maybe. But it seems like around 3rd, 4th, 5th is good.
Abilities start ramping up, right? Like thief abilities every 4 levels, they do something.
It's true. In original D&D, it went 1, 5, 9, 13. So I've slightly ironed that away from what's in original D&D too. So if I was completely traditional, that would start at 5th as well.
It's an odd mathematical sequence to remember, though. I think 4, 8, 12.
I agree.
Nice.
I agree with that. That's why I did it.
Okay.
Yeah. Totally.
Great. 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 So I will. So since we're talking about 5th edition a little bit indirectly,
yeah.
I will point out that actually the complexity in fighters in 5th edition is something that originally really put me off of 5th. My first experience playing 5th.
Okay.
It took me a long time to come around to really appreciating 5th edition. My first experience, I sat down at a convention game and was handed a whole bunch of character sheets. What do you want to play? And I can't remember what level they were, 4th, 5th, something like that.
Okay.
And I said, well, I don't know 5th edition. I know there's a lot of complexity, so give me the easy one. I'll just take this fighter because that's my background. I thought, oh, fighters are easy.
Yeah.
And it was totally that War Master tactician type. And I start reading the character sheet, and it's all like, you have these extra dice, and you can assign them in this way. And just all the complexity does have boiled in there of a 4th level character. I thought, what is going on?
Yeah.
It was really overwhelming to me at the time. Now, the nice thing is, I think I just chose the wrong fighter. I would say that in 5th edition, the other branch, the veteran.
Champion.
Champion, thank you. Whew.
Yeah.
I think that branch is more straightforward and easier to wrap your head around and gives you that.
It is. But it's clearly deficient. I'm pretty sure. So now, am I a 5th edition expert? Absolutely not, right? But I have maybe looked at specifically these core classes. So I do actually have some idea of a fighter, and I was playing a fighter in a friend's game for a while in 5th edition. And so, in the free basic rules PDF, Wizards provides only that champion type. So it's very straightforward. There's almost no choices to be made about it. But in the player's handbook, they've got this War Master type, and it seems to my mind clearly much better. When I was making my choices. So I think that probably for any kind of even halfway decent optimizer or min-maxer in 5th edition, they would look at that and go, the champion is just clearly deficient. And if they didn't hand me a War Master, I'd be pissed off that I'm clearly being gimped in this game. Right. So probably no one would even dare provide a fighter champion track. In that kind of situation, because they'd probably get blowback because they're giving them a gimp character.
I don't know it well enough. I did make when I was running Vile Crypt at PAX Unplugged, I did make two fighter characters, and one was the War Master and one was the champion. And I think that possibly I made the champion. I'm trying to remember them now, but I think that the champion became more interesting because of the feats that I gave her. I think she ended up with the great weapon feats that are also kind of very powerful.
Okay. Yeah, with the War Master that I was playing, like up to maybe third level-ish or something like that, it was all kind of, even at that level, there was all kinds of options for me to trigger the ability at the key time. The champion has stuff that's like, it's kind of passive. It's happening all the time if it ever happens. You know, maybe if you get a high die roll. And with War Master, I had control in the key moments about when my abilities kicked in. So I felt like I had much more capacity control was happening.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's definitely a taste issue here, right? Like, a lot of people will say, well, I don't give a crap about min-maxing and eking every advantage out. And on the other case, I actually remember one of the players at that game at PAX Unplugged saying to me, this is my favorite build. You screwed it up just in this one spot. You should have changed X, Y. And I went,
With the champion, you're saying?
With the champion, yeah.
So specific. Okay.
It gets into like great. It was like a great weapon master, and they have a reach weapon, right? They use a halberd. Okay. There was a certain combination of like you took X and Y and Z, and it gave that player just this huge number of options to do just truly massive damage in the game. That was the interesting thing between that person and the War Master. The champion was able to just dole out huge damage.
I'm a newbie, right? I mean, I would like anybody in the chat who knows anything about 5th edition to chime in and tell me whether I'm right or completely off base about that instinct there.
We are definitely both kind of newbies to the whole like 5th edition character builds world.
Completely.
So, yeah.
But I gotta say, Paul, I had the same. Maybe we should, but I had the same experience actually. Of I sat down at maybe a year ago Total Con, and I said, I'm going to try this fifth edition thing. I'm going to try that. Sat down at the table, didn't actually had some confusion because it was an Adventurers League thing, and I was supposed to come with a character, and I didn't. So my bad. Sat me a table. They said, here is a stack of pre-gens. And I said, I'll take the simple one. I'll take the fighter, get a fighter. And it's a pre-generated first level fighter with a halberd or a pole arm, right? It's on the sheet that I've been handed. I go, great. And the DM comes around and says, what are you carrying? And I go, well, I'm so-and-so and I have this and I have a pole arm. And he's like, I really don't think that a pole arm is going to be useful indoors. Didn't you think about that before? You know, isn't that kind of a dumb thing to be carrying around? And I'm like, I didn't make a choice. I was just handed this as the official starting type in Adventurers League. Why are you blaming me about this? Right. So that was actually the very first interaction that I had with fifth edition was getting blamed for taking a pole arm as a dumb idea when I didn't actually choose it.
That's funny.
That might be more of an Adventurers League thing than a 5th edition thing, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. I mean, I think the interesting thing that we're coming to, the point that we can agree on, is that we are used to, as old school players, we are used to the notion that in the complexity scale of characters, that fighters are the easy choice. That fighters do not have a lot of complexity to them, and they're very easy to wrap your brain around. And I don't think that's true anymore. I think in 5th edition, effort was made in the name of balance to make all the characters have as much stuff.
And I think more, right, even it totally 100% agree. And more generally, just the idea that there is a gradation of complexity. The idea for us that some classes are more complex than others, and that there's this clear, pretty radical gradation between fighters and maybe thieves and maybe wizards or clerics. I think that clearly... I think that like in 4th edition, they really massively ironed out and said, we are going to have the exact same complexity to every class and the same number of abilities at every level is going to be perfectly synced up, is my understanding. And so 5th edition post that, they're all pretty much the same. They're pretty close to the same complexity level, is my understanding. Much, much more so than when we started out.
It's unfortunate, really, because it kind of, in the name of balance and fairness, it throws out the idea that players have different levels of skill and perhaps need a different approach, right? Like, I feel like I see this at my table all the time at conventions where a player who hasn't played the original edition comes up and says, oh, well, I don't really know old school D&D, so I don't want to play a spellcaster. Right, like they just immediately have that, like, well, that I know that's going to be more complicated, so don't give me a spellcaster.
Right. I mean, I remember this thing that Richard Garfield said many, many years ago, is that all games, as they evolve over time, evolve to satisfy the tastes of the experts. They evolve to satisfy the tastes of the expert players and not the new players. And so I think this is a pretty good example of that. Of we've had, you know, we've played with someone that said, in 3rd edition that said, oh, I'm not getting anything new to choose from this level. Well, this whole class is boring as a result of that. And so for expert players who are bored, if there isn't a large plethora of choices and decisions to make, well, the game has evolved to actually provide that no matter which class you take. And I agree that as someone that wants to engage new players and want to be welcoming and want to make the pathway in very easy, that I agree. I think it's a loss that I can't say, here's a bunch of mundane stuff. And if you know what a spike and a sword and a bow is, you know, you're going to be able to make reasonable decisions about how to use that stuff.
I feel like, especially when you talk about issues of advancement, inevitably you've moved out of the realm of one-off convention games. And you're really talking about campaign play, right?
Yeah, you're right.
And generally my approach when talking to people about old school campaign play is to point out, well, a lot of the complexity and a lot of the persistence, because also at this point I'm trying to defend against your character is squishy and is probably going to die, don't get attached, that a lot of that is at a different level. It's at the world level rather than the individual character level. Like, we collectively as a group of players have to enjoy expanding out our knowledge of the world, exploring the world that we're playing in, rather than put all the emphasis on your individual character. Because guess what?
Right.
First level character, probably not going to make it.
That's a really good point. That's
I'm
a really
always
good point.
Super yeah. worried that players who jump into a new, who are used to the newer editions, who jump into an old school campaign, are going to actually be really bummed when their character dies on session two.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we do need to. I mean, we do need to prepare them for that, and to say, please don't write a 20-page backstory because you're setting yourself up for disappointment there. So I agree. That's among the, as things have evolved, that's one of the major schisms, between the two modes of play. Yeah. And I would also say that I tend to emphasize, like, I think old school play was a little bit more about the team, I think, and less so about individual spotlights. So I try to sometimes emphasize is your role supporting the team? Is the team strong? Because that's really the emphasis here.
Right.
You do and please don't come to the table, and please don't spend time saying that character A has a backstory with character B, and that there's some kind of family struggle, and there's a you're gonna be spending time at the table with interpersonal conflict with the characters. That's not what the game is intended to be about, I don't think. But some people want that, and if that's what their game does, and that should be provided to them.
So you're saying that you shouldn't invent a pair of brothers who are fighting over ownership of the historical family spear. Like they shouldn't do that. That's what you're saying. So for background, Dan and I played these characters in an old school campaign
for
a huge amount of enjoyment for years.
For like a decade and a half, I think.
I think it all started, we rolled our stats and they were nigh identical, right? We had just randomly 3d6
right.
down the line.
Yes.
They were
right.
almost identical.
And we were sitting next to each other.
And we were like, well, I guess we're brothers. I don't remember how the family spear came about. One of us had a spear and one of us didn't. And then there was an argument over whose spear it was.
Right. Right. Correct. Now, we didn't write that in advance. Okay. Now, first of all, allow me to quote my father and say, don't you dare ever use my own words against me. But in addition to that, we didn't write the conflict in advance. So I'm going to hang my hat on that distinction that we didn't write the conflict in advance. It came through naturally through actual play.
Yeah, I feel like I had a discussion with someone else over Twitter about this recently, who had made the point of actually explicitly choose, because a lot of people he felt were coming to this conclusion of like, don't write a lot of backstory, that he was going to buck the system and write a huge amount of backstory.
Yeah,
and I was like, if you're having fun with it, and as long as you're on the same page with your DM, that's fine.
Yeah.
And then he made the point of like, it's fine because if the character dies, that's cool too. I don't mind. I'm not going to be put off if the character dies because then there's this whole interesting thing in the world of this character with this backstory that existed. And I'll have just as much fun
I think
in
I
the
saw
next
that.
One. And I was like, well,
I think I saw that.
That's I don't think a lot of people have that mentality, but that's great.
Yeah.
And really my point is just like, again, just make sure you're on the same page as your GM, because I don't know, as a GM, I certainly worry. I would worry if I was playing a traditional old school game with like save or die mechanics all over the place, and someone shows up at my table with 10 pages of backstory of going like, oh, they're going to be so mad at me. They're going to hate me.
I agree. I mean, there's this implied, possibly inferred promise that is the DM going to pick up on that and actually use that in the story? And some newer DMs do commit to that, and some old school DMs do not think about committing to that. So I certainly hope that no one's disappointed on that particular score.
Right. And I think that there can be, you can play fun games where that is the expectation, where the DM wants everybody to write backstory and then does a bunch of homework to intertwine those backstories. And a lot of the gameplay becomes character personal, interpersonal relationships, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And that's fine. It's just a different style of play, and there's nothing wrong with it, I don't think, as long as everyone has the same expectations.
Right.
When you get in trouble is when people sit down at the table, and I think we're going to play game A, and you think we're going to play game B, and we don't realize that we're playing different games until halfway through.
I say yes. Admittedly, I haven't done that, right? I say yes, and admittedly, I got to admit, I come to the game, and I say, we're playing old school D&D, and still I'm not... I'm not at the tip top level of informing people exactly what that entails. So I myself might need to improve on that score.
Yeah. I think I got much better at it when I started running horror games, where I would come to the table and say, like, okay, I'm giving you pre-gen characters. They have a lot of backstory. There's going to be a lot of conflict. They're all going to die horribly. We all agree that that's the fun part, right? Yeah. We all agree that your character's inevitable death or madness is what we're here for. And like, I'm going to bring it back. Like, like needing to specify that fighters can use all kinds of weapons.
Right.
It's something, you know, maybe we got used to the fact that D&D, we didn't have to say these things because it was the implied base. And now there's enough variety out there in the world that we maybe need to say out loud what the implied baseline is.
Yeah, and I can, you know, and I can be sympathetic to older guys and women who are a little bit frustrated at needing to spend extra energy and extra time explicating these things that were at one point the cultural standard. And I can see why, if you didn't have to spend the energy and the words on that, why you're, you know, a little slightly frustrated at the additional level of work that it's required that you didn't used to have to do. So I can be sympathetic to both sides. I want everybody to be, you know, entertained by what we're doing. In addition, so on that same point about, I guess, to bring it back to the issue specifically about fighters and the relatively really small amount of choice you have for, you know, character rule-based abilities. Let's have a talk right now about race, Paul. You want to do that right now?
No.
So I can't avoid pointing out that of the races in original D&D, dwarves, hobbits, elves, you have no choice except to be a fighter. If you're a dwarf in volume one, you're a fighter automatically. There is no other choice. You cannot be a cleric. You cannot be a wizard. If you're a hobbit, you are a fighter. That's it, right? If you're an elf, you're a fighter and you're a wizard. So interestingly, there's this default, right? This base assumption that most people in the world, most soldiers in the world, most people that show up on the wandering monster charts, most people that show up in castles, the majority percentage of those people are all fighters. And, if you are a dwarf or a hobbit to begin with, you have no other choice except to be a fighter. That's literally it. Now, when you get to the first supplement and you bring in thieves, now all of a sudden here comes a choice, because dwarves and hobbits and elves can actually be thieves. And now you have a choice that you can pick your race and you can pick thief if you want. To begin with, if you want to be a hobbit, you're a fighter. That's it.
I think we both will agree that the elf stands out there as being this weird anomaly that was also really difficult to wrap your head around, because the rules in OD&D around how the heck the elf works between being both a fighter and a wizard are very unclear. Both, I think, gnashed our teeth on that one quite a lot. We come to a thing, I think, that we both agree is good, but it took a while, as I recall.
And we're in good company, right? Even the oldest school people that research OD&D, I mean, it really, it's one of those gaps. It's one of those very ambiguous gaps that allows 1,000 different theories to flourish. And many, many different people run original D&D elves in many different ways. There's a point where it's unclear and possibly self-contradictory in one paragraph. And so many, many people have different takes on it.
It's interesting, I think, though, that if we just turn our eye away from elf and we look at hobbit and dwarf, why can't they be magic users or clerics?
Well, why was that? Are there any dwarf magic users in Tolkien, for example? I mean, I think that it's very I should probably think more about that before I just run my mouth off. I feel like there's probably not many examples of that in the literature. I mean, does Tolkien have any hobbit wizards?
Yeah, no, not really.
Right. I mean, are there any dwarven wizards? So now the elf, right? The elf, you can point very specifically to Paul Anderson's Three Hearts and Three Lions, is that when the lead character, Holger Carlson, goes to the castle of the fairy elven lord, the host of elves comes out, and they're very specifically described as they are both warriors and wizards, it says. And so you just strip that line out and you have the original D&D elf. But I don't think you have any real historical precedent for the other types. And so
here's a point from William that I rather like. Perhaps is trying to imply that magic users are rare in the world. This was actually, when I first got into BX, there was a little while there where I was really enjoying Race's class and saying, because they're totally different things, right? And this always felt very Tolkien-esque to me, of like, wizards are not humans. They're not men. They're not elves. They're not dwarves. They're wizards. They're a separate thing entirely.
Okay. Right?
Or vice versa, that elves are just out of our understanding, right? That they're a totally separate thing. Wizards and elves, totally different.
Okay.
I don't know. It's a take, right?
Certainly, I'm not fond
of
the
impression from Tolkien, right, that wizards are maybe a separate race, right? Like, what are wizards? Can any normal young person growing up in the Tolkien world decide to become a wizard?
I should totally read Tolkien someday. but yeah, no, I get it. The whole whatever angelic type that they come from or whatever. Yeah.
I remember, actually, I think I read recently somebody was pointing out that the name Gandalf came from the origins of Wand Elf. And so that possibly Gandalf is an elf. And okay. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I'm no Tolkien scholar either. So, yep. And then one could argue, how much was this the Tolkien game and how much is this an amalgam of everything fantasy ever? And there's some Tolkien, but it's not all Tolkien.
True.
I don't know.
True. I mean, I would like wizards to be relatively rare. So, I mean, that's a really good point. Mm-hmm. They're not for everybody. That's a really good point. And I got to admit, you can more easily make that argument about all the non-fighters being some kind of special something, the clerics being divinely chosen, the magic users having some kind of supernatural whatever, elves, dwarves, and hobbits, and then that rather distinctly breaks down when you bring thieves in, because they're clearly not that. So that's actually a really interesting perspective, actually.
Man, thieves just broke everything.
Yeah, that's legitimate. That's really legitimate. And yet they kind of are really obvious to me. They're a really obvious thing that was lacking is, where is Grey Mouser and where is Elric's friend, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
And
where's Cottrell the Clever?
Right. Yes, exactly. Yep. And when Gygax wrote up Conan, he wrote him up as a multi-classed fighter thief. Originally, so it seems like that thiefly specific sneaking around type stuff, that's part of the pulp literature, and that really ought to be there, I would argue. Yeah. Not everybody agrees with that, obviously. The Maiar, thank you. Right, thanks, Joshua. Right.
I don't know. One can almost understand where systems like GURPS came in and decided, let's just point by everything. Screw it. We're not gonna bucket abilities together anymore. That's a whole other can of worms. But
yeah, because I think I can see why you tried to do that, and then it turns out, boy, that makes the design super difficult. It makes its design just super complicated to understand. And anytime the DM wants to make an NPC, it's just like this ginormous amount of work.
Yep.
Me as DM needing to populate the world, I really like being able to come in and say, there's an eighth level fighter, kabam. That's more or less what I need to know about him. Yep. There's a 10th level wizard over there, more or less done.
Yep.
So maybe we, before we run out of time, maybe we should just touch back upon that. Again, the original D&D fighter, it was one paragraph, and the first half was, you can use any magical weapon or sword you like. And the back half was, you can become a baron and run a domain and have people paying you tax money. Like I say, I feel like that latter part was promised, but always really sketchy and wasn't really fully developed in any of the original books.
There's like a whole section, isn't there, on like the cost for various parts of your castle.
Correct.
Right? It gets into the economics of it without actually telling you, but how do we play this game? How does D&D, how does roaming around the countryside fighting monsters evolve into a game of Civilization or Sim Battle.
I agree.
Or whatever.
I agree.
It sounds. Yeah. I don't know. It sounds cool. I want to. I guess I want to play that game. I don't know. Maybe I don't want to play.
I do too. Sure. I do too. And many. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And many of us, I feel. I mean, so there's at least obviously the expectation that overall the world is generally run by fighters, right? The overall campaign world of D&D originally probably a whole bunch of castles with a bunch of barons, and they're mostly all fighters. I also have this feeling that I want to do that. I mean, that's where Catan comes from, to my understanding, is I think if I recall, the creator wanted a system that he could use in his D&D game originally, I think. And I think that's originally where Settlers and then Settlers of Catan and now Catan came from. As a matter of fact. So once again, it kind of flourished a whole lot of different things of people trying to fill in that gap that actually became other games.
Yeah.
Reminds I still want to play of, that game.
Reminds me a lot of, there was this sort of promise of, back in the day when I used to play Warhammer Fantasy Battles, right, we would paint our miniatures and we'd sit down and we'd fight Army A versus Army B. And then inevitably, we wanted context around that. And so someone would draw a map, and there would be territory control, and there'd be this whole like weird metagame that would start to evolve and would usually fall apart because we didn't have solid rules and we're making it up as we went. And like, oops, turns out we horribly imbalanced this one thing. And now the whole thing falls to pieces and okay, now it's not fun anymore.
That's interesting to hear about because sometimes, I mean, I've never actually fully engaged in that, but I start in on it and I'm like, it just seems like as soon as someone gets a little bit of an advantage, it seems like they would become an overwhelming avalanche in that meta game. And I haven't yet come up with a clear idea about how someone takes over part and then, and yet becomes overextended or something.
It also is really problematic in a game that is essentially a one-on-one game, and now you're playing with a big pool of players because there's going to be some small percentage who want to play a lot and a larger percentage of people who want to play less frequently.
Yes.
And how do you prevent the ones who want to play a lot from just winning all the time?
Great point. Great point. Great point.
Anyway,
great point.
Whole other topic.
Let
me get back to fighters. So we talked about I think we've covered just about anything I can think of in regards to fighters. Do you have anything else?
Originally they're a very simple class, which is why I like them and why I like them having in the game and being able to hand them as the very first entry point to someone who's never played any D&D at all.
I like one interesting thing is I like I typically will play wizards. That's usually my choice.
Yeah.
If I only ever played wizards, I would get sick of it. And every now and then we sit down to a game like I did last night, honestly, and I went, you know what? I've been playing a lot of wizards recently. Time to be a fighter. I'm just gonna hit stuff.
Great.
And it's really great. quite fun. Interesting characterization you can make there. You can a lot of different personality types you can come up with. It's I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to playing this character.
It's funny because I think I tend to play, like, I think recently I have been playing mostly fighters. And I think the same thing is like with an old school understanding is we come to a new game, actually. Like, I come to a new game and I'm perfectly in my, I kind of go, well, as an entry point, I should that be my entry point? And for some reason, I've been playing a lot of fighters because even if I come into a game, I guess my very first thing is like, what can I do to round up the party, right? I'm not that philosophically engaged, and I'm going to develop the character over time as we play. So my very first thing is like, what are we missing? What can we use? And quite frequently, it's like, well, we're pretty well rounded. We can always use more fighters. Yeah. And then I also have the sensibility of, if you know my character can get murdered any time, I will put my body out in front. I'm happy to be that guy. So I'll be at front. I'll take the shot. I'm okay with this guy going down. And then I wind up being. And then hey, look, I'm at the front of the action all the time, and I have all kinds of interesting stuff happening around me.
I mean, here's an interesting thing. Fighters. I think every game I've played in, always benefits from having at least one player who is willing, who has a bias towards action, who is willing to just say, we have been arguing too long, I kick down the door, right? Somehow that always seems to fall to the fighter, I think. It's much more likely that the fighter's going to do it because he's not poring through lists of spells. Oh, we have this. Oh, we could do this option. No, the fighter's looking at, well, I hit things with a stick. That's my main that's my main ability here. Is there anything to hit here with a stick? No, I kick down the door and look for things to hit with a stick.
Right. You're right. Right. It gets it's like ante in poker, gets the action started.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm enjoying being that. That's totally my character that I made last night. I am the jerk who's just like, let's do it. Let's go. and I'm enjoying playing that against, actually, I rolled a reasonably high intelligence. So I'm playing a character who's not a dummy.
Okay.
He's not an idiot.
Yep.
He's not just going to take arbitrary risk, but he likes it, man. He just likes it. Let's get in there. Let's do stuff.
Well, I think I had the character for a while when we were playing together who also had a fairly high intelligence, but I also played him as completely out of his mind drunk most of the time. So on the one hand, he had tactical presence of mind, but then not wisdom presence of mind, I think is how I was playing that. So let's touch on these two interesting comments we've just had. So Joshua was asking in my OED rules, where I have Great Cleave, which I just ripped out of third edition, basically. You chop down one person, you get another attack, and you keep going if you want to. You're asking, did that completely replace the standard original rule of multiple attacks versus one hit die creatures? The answer is yes. You're right. I didn't like that as a standard ability. I don't like spending time rolling lots and lots of dice for everybody all the time. That was a great example there of that was my interpretation of the D20's Great Cleave feat was of recreating that standard thing. So for me, it is actually a replacement. Now I got to admit, I did that at a time when looking at the original D&D rules, it doesn't explicitly exactly say that fighters do that. And so my interpretation was, I guess that's technically not in those rules, but actually just recently, last month, I've become convinced that that's how Gygax always played it consistently from chainmail to original to first edition. So now I'm convinced that that was the intention. And I was thinking, do I need to go back and change that? As that has actually been on my mind in the last couple of weeks, but I play it where you need the Great Cleave feat to get those multiple attacks.
I enjoy it as a nice variation from the Rapid Strike, which is just two attacks all the time, right? This is more specialized. It's only against certain kind of enemy types, but could chain into a whole lot of attacks. That's your wade into an army of goblins and just take down everyone around.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I usually describe it as a whirlwind. I mean, like in third edition, they had a separate feat called Whirlwind Attack. But usually when that starts happening, I actually personally describe it as this particular fighter just goes into a crazy Wuxia style whirlwind of death. And chops through an ungodly number of bodies in 10 seconds or so. So and I don't want that to be all the time. I like that being a special, it only happens once in a while and it takes everybody's breath away. And the players that weren't accustomed to that are kind of stunned at what just happened. And I kind of like that being a special once in a while thing.
Yeah. Nice. All right. Thanks for asking. Final thoughts on Fighter there, Dan?
I like fighters. I like having a gradation of complexity.
Yeah.
Right. I really like original D being a gradation of complexity. I like being able to hand anybody as here's the first thing we've all started with. And you will be very comfortable and you will definitely understand what's happening with this particular character type. And I like it being the default.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of introducing new people to the game, which frankly is my jam. I love introducing new people to the game. Any variation.
Favorite thing.
Being able to have that ability to say, you've played a lot, you're a master, these are the classes you want, this is your first time ever playing, maybe try this class. I think that's really nice, and I think that is unfortunately kind of missing from 5th edition these days. With the exception of maybe that is the champion, that's something they were after with the champion, maybe? Not sure.
Maybe, yeah.
If it is, maybe. I gotta say, well done, Monty designers. Good on you for having noticed the need for that, because it took me a while to get there.
Great. Crit Crate.
If you kind viewers have any thoughts on fighters across the different editions, or any questions, more questions about how we rule fighters in OD&D, or want to tell us how terrible our 5th edition fighter builds are and give us some advice, please leave some comments here in the video. We'd love to hear from you.
We totally need that. I totally agree. Of course, remember that you can like and follow and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and also Facebook, actually, by the handle Wandering DMs on all of those social media sites.
Excellent. And you can listen to our show in audio-only podcast format if you prefer that format. That's available on our website at wanderingdms.com and through various podcast carriers such as Google Podcast and iTunes and Spotify, etc. If you are listening to this on one of those podcast carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us. That helps get the word out about our show and really helps us quite a lot.
That's right, Paul. I totally agree with that. Thanks to all of our patrons who support the show here. We could not do what we're doing without your help. If you would like to join them, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll see the different tiers that we have and the different bonuses that we have for those tiers, which would be we would really appreciate. We do have 4 shows a week here on Wandering DMs. So queue up for Tuesday night with me and Paul for Solo DM, Thursday night for 10 Dead Rats, Saturday night for more Book of War game. Boy, last night was really intense, I got to say. So I couldn't sleep for a while last night, actually. And of course, do look for our next talk show, which will be next Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Just looking at my notes here, Paul, it looks like we have a guest next week, and that guest is Mr. Ernie Gygax, I believe. So look for that on Sunday, May 10th.
Excellent. Yeah. Very much looking forward to talking to Ernie Gygax. I think that's going to be a great conversation. So please come back and join us for that.
Yeah, me too. Please join us then for Ernie Gygax and another thought-provoking discussion next week.
We'll see you then.